This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Following the Republican state convention, three candidates have emerged with a chance to take on Governor Malloy in November. Leading the pack is Tom Foley, the 2010 nominee, who got the party's endorsement and is a clear frontrunner, according to the most recent Quinnipiac poll. Mark Boughton, the mayor of Danbury, who was Foley's running mate in 2010, also emerged with enough delegates to qualify for the primary. As did John McKinney, the outgoing Senate minority leader. McKinney's served in the state Senate for 15 years and is stepping down to make this run. Today, Where We Live, we continue our Where We Vote series, where we give you a chance to ask questions of the candidates. You can call us at 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. We're also joined today by the cameras of CTN. I want to welcome into our studio John McKinney, Senate Minority Leader, Republican candidate for governor. Welcome back to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be on, and thank you for having me.
First of all, why are you running for governor?
Well, the easy answer is because I love Connecticut. I'm 50 years old. I've spent all 50 years living in Connecticut. I was born in Fairfield, Connecticut. I still live in Fairfield, Connecticut. I've got three kids, three teenagers. My oldest just graduated from high school, and I want them to spend their lives in Connecticut. I want my sisters and brother who live in Connecticut to be able to afford to stay here. The reality is my son's a perfect example. He's going off to college in the fall, and many of his friends, when they graduate from college, won't be able to come back to Connecticut, either because there won't be a good job for them or they won't be able to afford to live here. That's a trend that I'd like to see reverse. Many of my friends, people my age, my peers, we're seeing our parents move away to other states because it's more affordable. Just yesterday I saw someone I hadn't seen for a very long time, and she said, I hope I'm around to vote for you, but my husband and I have put the house on the market because we just can't afford Connecticut anymore. And she was very sad to tell me that, not because I might lose a vote, but because she had spent her whole life in Connecticut. So, look, we're still in trouble in our state. Our state budget is structurally unsound. We're looking at billion-dollar budget deficits. Our economy continues to lag the rest of the region and the nation. We have too many people who are out of work, chronic unemployed, who've given up work looking for jobs. So we have many challenges, and I want to bring my voice and my vision to help meet those challenges and help make people like my son and college graduates happy to move back to Connecticut, like my friend Patty, who's putting her house on the market, not want to put her house on the market. That's why I'm running for governor.
We hear about this an awful lot, and we've done many shows about this, about why young people specifically want to leave the state. Part of it is, a lot of young people just want to leave the place that they grew up. But we see a migration from other northern places, including places in the Rust Belt, say, that aren't as unaffordable to live as Connecticut. A lot of it has to do with opportunity. Some of it just has to do with quality of life, though. So I think that there's a balance for whoever's running the state. It's not just about, low taxes and making sure people can afford an apartment or a house. It's also about having a place where they want to thrive, can be entrepreneurial, where they can actually do something and have some excitement. At the end of the day, John McKinney, New York City is not terribly affordable. Manhattan isn't. But people still want to go there. They always have.
Well, sure. It's never one thing. And I think if any politician tells you that, they're being too simplistic. And I also think we need to recognize if you're 21, 22, and a recent college graduate, Connecticut is situated between two great cities, Boston and New York. They're very attractive places for college graduates to want to be. So in part, to attract those people, we need to understand what it is that a 20-something-year-old is attracted to. You need to have a good job. You need to have an ability to be able to get to that job if it's not by a car, by a mass transportation. You need to have affordable housing and workforce development housing, not just affordable housing, that they can get into as a first step in the market. And you need to be able to have some type of an urban culture that's going to be attractive to them, a social life, arts and entertainment is very important if you're in your 20s. But the bigger issue, John, I think, is understanding that, okay, we may lose some college graduates to larger urban areas for their chance to explore life, which is, I think, what we all wanted to do at some point. But we need to make sure we get them back. Because many people, once they reach a certain age and maybe they're going to get married, maybe they want to start a family, or maybe they just want a slower, you know, different lifestyle, that's when they want to come home. That's where they want to be with their friends, their family, they're close to their parents. And that's where we're not bringing people back. And that's, again, because the good jobs aren't available like they might be in other places. Connecticut's not as affordable. Down in my neck of the woods in Fairfield County, it's hard to attract someone to say, live in Fairfield, where you can tell them if you're working in Stanford, you can get in a car and it's going to take you maybe an hour and 15 minutes to drive 15 miles. Or you could take the train, but the problem is you're going to wait 5 years to get a parking sticker to park at the train station, and the train is unreliable. So there are a lot of problems. It's not just one thing. It's not just low taxes, although I would argue that's very important. It used to be that the big difference between living in New York and Connecticut years ago was a huge tax differential. That huge tax differential has been lost, and I think it's one of the reasons why we've become less competitive with New York or New Jersey.
We're talking with John McKinney. He's a state senator. He's a Republican who is running for the Republican nomination. He's going to be part of a primary election coming up. Tom Foley and Mark Boughton are also on that primary ballot. We'll be talking with them as well in our Where We Vote series. Right now, we're giving you a chance to ask questions of a candidate at 860-275-7266. And we'll get some calls in for you in just a moment. Just this past weekend on WFSB's Face the State, you were talking about the primary campaign. Here's what you had to say.
I don't think you can convince people that you can make Connecticut a great state and be positive if you're attacking other people, and I'm not going to do it.
So this idea of not attacking your opponents in this Republican primary, can you just talk a little bit about that? Because I think one of the things I want to know is, how are you different from these other guys? In order to make some clear lines of distinction, probably you're going to have to say some things about them that they might not like so much.
Well, no, I disagree with that. A lot of people have said to me, can you really engage in a campaign and not attack your opponent? I've even had some people suggest it's a sign of weakness, That's quite, ridiculous thought. I think it's a great sign of strength to be able to say, I have a vision for the state of Connecticut. Here's who I am. Here's what I believe. And here's what I want to do specifically as governor. And if that is not something that a majority of Republicans in a primary or a majority of Connecticut voters want, they will pick somebody else. I've run for office 8 times. Every time I've run for office, I've always known that it's not my job. It belongs to the people. They get to elect their representative, and you have to be willing to live with their decisions. So I think you can differentiate yourself without attacking someone else. I certainly have been very aggressive in going after Governor Malloy, where I've disagreed with his policies. I've stood up where I've agreed with him as well, and I don't think that has been personal or negative attacks. I also, John, I talk to so many people every day as a state senator, as a dad, and now running for governor. I've talked to people across the state of Connecticut. Most people are sick and tired of the negativity and the personal attacks and the partisanship that they see in Washington. So I want to show them that you can do this the right way. But more importantly than that, they're just worried about, right now, their job, their family, their budgets, their lives. How do you afford to send kids to college? How do I save for my retirement? They don't really care whether you're a Republican or Democrat. They want to know what you can do to help them and what government is going to do to help versus hurt small business owners, for example.
Could you explain – and we're going to play in just a moment something from former Senator Lowell Weicker, who was on our program recently talking about the state of the Republican Party. But before we get to that, I'd like you to maybe lay out how you feel Republicans in Connecticut are different from Democrats at all. I mean, you say something that a lot of people say. It doesn't really matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat, but clearly it is a, for better or for worse, a two-party system. You're trying to differentiate yourselves from Democratic Party politics. How are Republicans in Connecticut any different than Democrats?
Well, let me just first clarify why I say people don't care the difference, because I think people in Connecticut are very independent-minded voters, and they're willing to vote for the best candidate or the person who they believe can do the best job or has the best ideas. I do think there are important differences. First, I think we've seen a dramatic difference between two philosophies. When Governor Malloy was elected, we all understand that our state faced a very large budget deficit. It was not something he made. Quite frankly, it was something that was passed by the Democrat legislature. I wish he would at least acknowledge that. And a budget not signed by Governor Rell, a budget that I urged her to veto. The difference in approaches was we knew that raising taxes on the people of Connecticut was going to hurt families, hurt small business owners, and hurt our economy, that government spending is out of control. And we proposed a budget that was fully vetted by our nonpartisan Office of Fiscal Analysis, a balanced budget that didn't raise taxes. Governor Malloy took a different road, a road he called shared sacrifice, that was the largest tax increase in state history. I think you can look back and understand that Connecticut has seen our economy shrink. New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island saw their economies grow. Connecticut has not recovered all of the jobs lost during the recession. New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island have. I think the reason for that is because of the large tax increase. And it works with families. It works with small business owners. If you're a family and you saw your taxes go up, you had to pay more in income tax, sales tax. You had to pay more for gasoline, goods and services, more for food, more for clothes that before didn't have a sales tax and now did. You have less money to put into the economy. You have less money to save, say, for college. If you're a small business owner, and I talked to a lot of small business owners, they were saying, look, John, we had to put thousands of dollars aside just to pay the government. If we didn't have those higher taxes, we would have invested that money in our business or hired more people. So I think that's a very a stark contrast and the most significant difference between the Democrats who are running Connecticut and the Republicans that I'm part of is how we manage our state government, how much we spend, and how we tax our citizens.
That $3.6 billion deficit that Governor Malloy was given did come after two successive Republican governorships. Whether or not that was something that budget was one that was supported by Governor Jody Rell or not, she had the ability to change that, and she didn't as governor of Connecticut. Before that, we had a governor who ended up spending a lot of money on various projects. Some of those projects were done with friends of his. He ended up going to jail for that. He is facing a criminal indictment once again. Make the case why a Republican governor would do a better job than those two Republican governors did that ended up with a $3.6 billion deficit, and the other one of them went to jail for corruption charges.
Well, look, I think you're being a little unfair in saying that because John Rowland was a corrupt governor who went to jail, that all Republicans can't lead.
I'm just asking you to make a case because what a lot of people are asking is, you know, look, we have one party rule in Connecticut, right? We have Democrats running everything, and Republicans can make a case. Well, we can maybe fix things by having some balance here. But the last two Republican governors gave us a very large budget deficit. John Rowland also signed a very long-term deal with state employees, and then he ended up firing some of those state employees, incurring a lawsuit against us, which has cost us more money. I'm saying make the case why a Republican governor would help to fix things given what we've seen over the course of the last couple of decades.
Well, I feel the need to at least correct some of the record. Jody Rell faced a veto-proof majority of Democrats. Yeah. They could override everything she did. The last budget, which gave us a $3.5 billion deficit, was supported only by Democrats. There wasn't a single Republican who supported it. When the budget passed, I stood up and I said, this will give us a $3 to $4 billion deficit, and it did. I wish she had vetoed it, but given the fact that she faced a veto-proof majority and the Democrats would have overridden her veto, she let the budget become law without signing it. A mistake, but can't blame her. I would also say, because I think it's important to note, that at the time, Governor Malloy was running for governor. He was mayor of Stamford, and he never weighed in on how that budget was going to cost a $3.5 billion budget deficit. He never even criticized his party for passing that budget. Look, I have a very distinct vision and set of ideas for the state of Connecticut. One is that our government spends too much. It's too big, and we need to spend less money. The principal way that I think we can change how we spend money in Connecticut is in utilizing nonprofit organizations to help partner and deliver social services. We are a dual delivery state where the state spends $2 for every dollar the nonprofit spends to take care of someone, an elderly person, a person with developmental disabilities, and the like. I think we ought to partner better with nonprofit organizations because they can care for people more efficiently, and I think do a better job, quite frankly, than the state can. I also think as a state, we need an independent auditor, an Office of Inspector General I've been fighting for almost a decade now, who will come in and have subpoena and audit power to go through every agency of state government to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. We know it exists, but we really don't do anything to go after it because the legislature's part-time and the administration doesn't have an interest in, you know, highlighting waste, fraud, and abuse within the administration. That's why an Office of Inspector General, who will be independent of the governor and the legislature, I think can do that. It's actually one of the very few areas where the federal government does a pretty good job. So, look, we can spend our money better. We can care for people without ripping up the safety net by using nonprofit organizations. We can root out waste, fraud, and abuse. That will significantly change how much money we spend in the state of Connecticut. And I think that's a big difference between what I am proposing and what Governor Malloy is proposing.
Let's go to the phones here. Aaron is calling from Waterbury. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, typically Republicans run on the premise that they're going to cut taxes and that's going to help us. And I just wonder, since we talk about deficits every day, how is cutting taxes going to help? Because then how are you going to fund the budget?
Well, it's a great question, Aaron. First of all, you've got to spend less money if you're going to be able to cut taxes. But, you know, the idea that cutting taxes is going to hurt citizens, I just simply would disagree with you. You know, before Governor Malloy was elected, if you wanted to buy clothing or footwear under $50, you paid no sales tax. As I said, I've got three teenagers. When they were younger, you could buy all of their clothes for less than $50. Go talk to a struggling single mom working two jobs with three kids about how her life has changed now that she has to pay almost 6.5% more to put clothes on her kids' back. Go talk to somebody about how much it more costs them to feed their family because sales taxes, gasoline taxes have gone up, which increases the price of goods at the supermarket. So I understand that we need to spend money to run the state. But even under a Republican budget, we're spending $19 billion plus, and the Democrat budget over $20 billion. We're going to meet the needs of the people of the state of Connecticut and focus on what government needs to focus on. But we need to understand that higher taxes have hurt our economy. They've hurt families, and they've hurt small business owners.
I want to take a break, and when we come back, people want to ask some other questions. We want to talk about gun policy in the state, talk about some other things that you want to ask John McKinney. He's a state senator who is running for governor, 860-275-7266. We'd like to hear from you with your questions on this Where We Vote edition of Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our Where We Vote series where we give you a chance to ask questions of the candidates for office. One of the three Republicans who's going to be on the primary ballot coming up this summer is John McKinney. He is running for that nomination against Tom Foley and Mark Bowden, who we'll also have on the program. And, of course, the winner of that contest hopes to take on Governor Daniel Malloy for his governor's job in November. If you want to join us with a question, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Ken, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, Ken. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Thank you so much. Senator McKinney, thank you for taking our questions. I have a quick question for you. The Sentencing Commission put forward a juvenile justice bill which would allow the reevaluation of sentences of minors who were sentenced, you know, juveniles who were sentenced as adults. This came with a consensus decision from the Sentencing Commission. Newt Gingrich and conservative firebrands approved Connecticut's sentencing bill. I mean, Justice David Borden from the Supreme Court was on the Sentencing Commission, and they all agreed with this. And you stonewalled it and roadblocked it. And I'm concerned, A, why you're taking a hard-on-crime line, and B, is this how you're going to govern? And I'd like to take my answer. I'm not in front of a radio. So.
Okay, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, no. Thank you. Well, first of all, Ken, thank you very much. Look, I think the substance is more important than the process, but quickly on the process, as is the right of any representative or senator, a number of members of my caucus and myself offered amendments to the proposed bill because we didn't like it in the form it was in and wanted to make some changes. I had instructed the Democratic leadership for weeks that if they wanted the bill to pass, they needed to call it earlier because, as you know, in the last couple of days of session, they always end up with too many things to pass.
We have noted this.
Right. And so just last point on the process. The Democratic leadership said specifically, we don't want to call the bill because we don't want to vote on the Republican amendments. So I didn't stonewall it. They didn't care enough about the bill to have a debate about our approach versus their approach. So let's talk about the difference of approach. And this, John, is trying to deal with a Supreme Court case which says if you've sentenced a juvenile to life, you need to reevaluate that sentence at some point. We thought that the bill required that reevaluation too early. And I'll give you the best example because it's the most recent example. We had that just horrible tragedy in Milford where a young high school student stabbed and murdered a fellow high school student, 16-year-old. Under the bill that had been proposed, that 16-year-old, if charged with and convicted of murder and sentenced as an adult to life in prison, would be eligible to have a reevaluation and released from prison before they're 40 years old. I just think that's too lenient for someone who commits that type of murder.
But we're talking about a teenager, and you're talking about the most horrific case that we can imagine. And we've honestly had so many horrific cases recently in Connecticut, but here is someone who would face trial for that. Why is reevaluation at 40 years old not something that you could take on? And what would be the magic age? What would be the number?
Well, what we wanted to do was not have a set reevaluation for all the different crimes. So you would take the most heinous of crimes and you would have a reevaluation longer, which means there would be a longer prison sentence. That's all we were looking for. We just thought in the most horrific cases, for someone to possibly get out of parole, to get out of prison after committing that type of murder before they're 40 years old is simply too early.
So, but what would the number be? How much longer would he need to spend in prison in order for it to pass your standard?
I don't think there's a magic number, but we had put different standards in that would have required that person to spend more time.
But I think
in
that
jail. That's
important. I mean, if you're saying I don't like this Democratic bill, then we want to know what the alternative. What's a better approach than the plan that would have allowed him to at least be evaluated at the age of 40?
Well, I think the better approach is that they would be evaluated after spending more time in prison. Maybe instead of spending 20 years in prison, they spend 40 years in prison. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's fair to the victims or to society that someone who commits that type of murder could be eligible to get out of prison that early.
Do you support the death penalty?
I do.
Obviously, we've seen some changes to the death penalty here in Connecticut. Do you think that the death penalty, as we've known it before, will ever come back to Connecticut? Is that something that you would actually support? Would you work to try to bring the death penalty back to the state?
I would support it coming back. How much effort and energy you use as governor, I can't commit to it this time because, quite frankly, John, there are so many more pressing and immediate issues related to helping families and small business owners with our economy. Look, I think in the most heinous of crimes, I think of Dr. Pettit and his family and that tragedy and other cases. I think of the, slaughter of the kids in Newtown. That person should be, I think, an appropriate punishment is the death penalty. I also, as someone who was a clerk on our Connecticut Supreme Court, who actually clerked for a justice who wrote an opinion on the death penalty, am very comforted by the multiple protections we have in Connecticut. There has never, and I want to emphasize this, never been any doubt about the guilt or innocence of people on Connecticut's death row like there have been in other states like Texas. And the like. So we had done it right in Connecticut. I would have kept it. If it wants to, if the legislator wanted to bring it back, I would support that. But there are so many important issues right now to help families in Connecticut. That's where I'm going to focus.
We got a tweet from Nancy who says, what would he want to see implemented in regards to gun control and improvement of access to mental health treatment in Connecticut? You supported the gun control legislation that Governor Malloy pushed for in the wake of Newtown. Of course, Newtown, very, very close to you. I'm wondering if you can talk about your support of the bill that passed and what you might do to potentially even go further if you were elected governor.
Well, I've talked about this a lot, and I understand that there are a lot of gun owners who disagree with the bill and some, if not many, who are very upset with those of us who voted for it. I've always believed as an elected representative, my job is to listen to my constituents and try to represent them as best I can. I'm the only voice of Newtown in the state Senate and obviously was there on that tragic day and believed my role was to help them and try to craft a policy that would not just deal with gun safety issues but school security and mental health issues. I've loved representing the people of Newtown every day, and I felt that was my obligation. I also, you know, have said to many people, and it's frustrating. It even angers me at times. We have one-party rule. As a minority, if we want to have no role in government, we can just stand on the sidelines and say no and criticize. But at the end of the day, if the majority is going to pass a bill, if we have an ability to shape that bill to make it look different or better, knowing that we're not going to get everything we want as a minority, I think it's your obligation as elected representative to do that. So I went into the room to try to help shape a bill. Republicans had brought in a series of recommendations. Democrats had brought in a series of recommendations. What finally passed was beyond what the Republicans had offered and fell short of what the Democrats – that's pretty much the tradition of a compromise and consensus. I don't know that we need to have more gun laws, to be honest with you. I think we should put more money in a gun trafficking task force because that has proven to get illegal guns off the streets, especially in our larger cities in Connecticut. And we need to continue to look at mental health issues. By far, John, the most difficult issues to deal with are those surrounding mental health. How do you identify young kids earlier? How do you because of the fear of misidentifying somebody, how do you provide support services for people who you identify with mental health issues? What do you do about adults, young men, maybe 20 years old, but adults who if they don't want to seek help or the like, you can't make them unless you're going to, you know, involuntarily commit them. Those are very difficult issues. I don't know that anybody has an answer, but I do know that we're all trying to work towards it. And I think we all realize, whether you voted for the bill or didn't, that we made some steps regarding mental health identification treatment. But there's a lot more to go.
And we may get back to gun policy in just a moment. But on this idea of mental health treatment, I think that what we hear from not just people running for governor, but politicians across the country in the wake of Newtown is we need to strengthen our mental health system. And I guess I'll ask you, be specific about what you think needs to be strengthened in our mental health system. And if you could, talk about how you will do that as you look forward to a budget which you say needs to be smaller. We need to spend less money as a state. And so how are we going to provide more services to people who need mental health services if indeed we spend less money?
Well, that is a $64,000 question, as they used to say. It's probably – numbers gone up, right?
$64 million or billion or something, yeah.
Look, again, there's a better model to deliver care for people, and that's a nonprofit delivery system model which can do things more efficiently and for less money than the state can do it. But in terms of specifically, one of the things you understand is that when you read about it, some of the mental health issues for young men tends to come on between, say, 18 and 24 years old. There are very limited services for that age group and how to deal with that. We need to improve support services for them. We need to have a better education and understanding as a society of mental health issues. I've long been a supporter of mental health parity in our insurance laws. One of the areas where I always admired former Lieutenant Governor, Senate President Kevin Sullivan from the West Hartford area was in his championing the rights of mental health.
Something that because of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, we now have across the nation.
Right. Well, we had mental health parity in Connecticut before Obamacare. We were doing our job and getting to the right place. And look, part of it is understanding that, and I have three kids. If one of my kids fell down the stairs and broke their leg, I'm going to take them to the doctor immediately. If one of my kids showed signs of asthma or Lyme's disease, I'm going to take them to the doctor immediately. But we have a stigma out there that says, well, maybe if my kid shows signs of depression or maybe something more serious, a bipolar or something of that nature, we want to hide that. We don't want to share that because we're embarrassed by that. And the reality is it's health related. It's a sickness. It's a disease. It's no different than having heart disease. And we need to be able to talk about that and have people go seek care and not feel ashamed about that. That's a huge part of getting us to a better to a better place, because more people will be forthcoming in looking at seeking and finding treatment and help. I think too many people sort of hide in the shadows with mental health because they're afraid to talk about it. We need to tell people, don't be afraid. It's nothing you've done wrong, and we need to get you help.
Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Willington. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on with John McKinney.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I just want to ask Senator McKinney what he feels the proper role of the state is in the special education field. You know, the federal government has mandates, IDEA, that says, autistic kids have to be, in a least restrictive environment. And what I'd like to know is that local school districts are struggling with special ed, and there's animosity toward the special ed students because the local districts sometimes are very small. And do you feel that the state should do more to help the local districts like in Pennsylvania, have a lot of money thrown at them and that sort of stuff? And what I asked this question of one of your other Republican candidates, and he kind of evaded it. So I hope you can give me a more direct answer. Do you think it's the state's responsibility or the local school district's responsibility?
Well, look, I think at the end of the day, it's all of our responsibility. Special education, you know, we went through the fight with No Child Left Behind, which was an unfunded mandate that the federal government imposed on states and treated Connecticut like Mississippi and California. We're living through, Common Core and other issues that tend to be a one-size-fits-all mandates. Special education is the largest unfunded mandate that the federal government's ever imposed on states, and that we, the states, have kicked the can down to the local level. In my hometown of Fairfield, I think the education budget, and I'm going to approximate the numbers, was about $1.2 million more than they had anticipated. And they weren't underestimating the costs. And that's something that they had to bear. So you see fights at the local level about whether kids have to pay to play sports, whether you're going to cut, international language programs because of these costs. I don't think the state has done a good enough job in the area of special education. Again, in a world where I think we spend too much, you have to make difficult choices. What I would do is try to relieve our municipalities of some of the unfunded mandates that have been imposed on them, and I think the state needs to pick up a bigger share of the special education costs.
I want to get you a quick call from Kathy here. Kathy's in East Haddam. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. There are such a large number of retirees who are moving their permanent residence out of state, either to a state with no income taxes, such as Florida, or graduated incentives, such as South Carolina. And people are moving for reasons including these taxes on their pensions. And I would like to ask the senator what his ideas are for retaining us here in Connecticut.
Well, thank you, Kathy. You know, Kathy, just a couple of days ago, I was at a retirement dinner for a longtime teacher and athletic director in the town of Trumbull, Connecticut. And I had a gentleman come up to me and wish me luck in my race for governor, but lamented that he couldn't support me. And I knew who he was. He was a retired teacher. And he said that he had become a Florida resident. Why? Because his pension that he's earned over time is worth more in Florida than it is in Connecticut because of our taxes. Kathy, we need to reform our tax code. Do I want to have lower taxes on the people of Connecticut? I do. But perhaps more important than how much taxes we collect is how we collect them. We collect taxes in ways that are disincentives for people to live or do business in Connecticut. You've brought up one of the best examples. There is no reason why you or anyone else – I've got a brother who's a public school teacher going on almost 25 years in the Bridgeport school system – should work most of your lives, earn a pension, and then move to Florida because that pension's worth more. We should not be taxing pensions and Social Security in the state of Connecticut because it forces people to make choices to leave Connecticut. That's one of the bad choices that have been made. Nobody's to blame for it, but we need to correct it.
Well, if we don't tax pensions, but we tax people who are, I assume, younger and don't have pensions, aren't we shifting the burden onto people who are in their prime earning years? I mean, we're not going to have John McKinney moving down. There are a whole lot of people with pensions. That's going, you know, out the window. People are saving on their own. They're saving in their own retirement accounts. The number of people who have pensions right now is going to shrink dramatically over the years. If we say we're not going to tax pensions, that means we got to tax somebody else, don't we?
Well, first of all, you've given the argument why I think we should do it now, because we're not going to have that money at some point in the future. And it's too important to keep people who are leaving the state here. Look, in a local community, one of the reasons why so many towns and cities engage in aggressive senior property tax relief is because they understand both the economic and human value of keeping our seniors here. The economic value is if we have an older couple who don't have any more kids, who are in the school system, living in their house a lot longer, that means someone like me with three kids isn't buying their house, and that's an additional cost to the community. But there's a much more important human element, which is, you know, you want your parents to live where you are, where their grandkids will be. You want people who've helped build a community to be able to live in that community, to share their experiences and stories. So because it's going to not be, you know, a tax that's going to bring in more income in the future, because we are moving away from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, I think we ought to do it now. Look, we're going to have lower taxes when I'm governor. But at the end of the day, and I know, you know, the Democrat spinmeisters are all out there right now, and you got to be careful what you say. But even if it was raising the same amount of taxes, there's a better way to do it than going after people's pensions and Social Security.
I listen to the Democratic spinmeisters now. John McKinney says he wants to raise the exact same amount of money in taxes. Well, we'll see about that. If you want to call us and join us, 860-275-7266. Let's get to one more call before this break. Tom's in Naugatuck. Hi there, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing? I had a question for the senator. It's related to taxes and small businesses. The Department of Revenue Service, in recent years, since I've been in practice, I represent taxpayers in front of the DRS and IRS. They have been very aggressive with the way that they handle small business owners that owe sales taxes to the state. And I wanted to know if the senator had any comment on that. You know, they charge them with crimes, so we're not just dealing with it in terms of a collection aspect, but we're dealing it in terms of holding a jail sentence over somebody to make sure that they pay their sales tax. So I understand there's a legal distinction there. I understand that they can do that. That's the law. But I think that if the DRS was willing to work more with small business owners so that they're not running them out of business and threatening to throw them into jail, it could help. It could be helpful for the environment in Connecticut. So I wanted to see if the senator had any comment.
Well, thank you, Tom. And Tom, I've actually heard that from small business owners that I represent since the recession and since our economy's really been struggling. 2008, pretty much when the recession started, state and federal tax collection agencies have been far more aggressive. I think, Tom, it's a bigger problem in that too many small business owners think that state government is working against them, not working with them. Look, when it comes to, you know, the collection of sales taxes, we want to make sure that all small business owners are paying what is due to the government. But, you know, we need an agency that's going to work with them to get the collection, not sort of threaten them. And I think that's more of a cultural shift we need to have. A lot of small business owners have told me that anytime they deal with certain state agencies, they always feel that they're not dealing with someone who's there to help them, but more someone who's more antagonistic.
But
and we need to change that.
Yeah, but you talked earlier, though, about rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse in state government. I mean, with that same eye in mind, shouldn't the state government, when it can work to collect taxes against small business owners who haven't paid their taxes, or whether or not it's an agency that has to regulate, say, environmental dumping? I mean, shouldn't we go after those who are not doing right by our state just as aggressively as we might root out waste, fraud, and abuse in the government that we're paying for?
Oh, we should. But, what did Ronald Reagan say? The nine most dangerous words were, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help." The question is, how do you go about doing it? And threatening jail sentences, if it's a first instance, is a little, overhanded and a little bit strong. So, yes, absolutely. Look, everything that's owed and due should be paid and that should be just as equally as important to us as making sure that someone who's not eligible for a program doesn't get that program. They're two halves of the you know, the pie.
We're talking with John McKinney. He's a state senator who's running for governor. When we come back, maybe a little lightning round. There's a lot of questions people have, and I want to get to a lot of topics here. CTN, the Connecticut Network, is also here with their cameras today. You can call us at 860-275-7266. You can send us an email, wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, a special edition of our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We're going to welcome in, along with Colin McEnroe, as always, author, political activist, and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader. We'll talk about his new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. We'll get a chance for you to ask questions of Ralph Nader on The Wheelhouse tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, it's our Where We Vote series, where we're giving you a chance to ask questions of the candidates for top office, including John McKinney, who's Senate Minority Leader and a Republican candidate for governor. He's stepping out of his role in the state Senate after some 15 years in the job in order to run for governor. We've been taking questions on a wide variety of topics. Let's just go to a few things quickly. Do you support expansion of charter schools in Connecticut?
I think we need to work with charter schools as an available public school option, but not at the expense of our existing public school system. Over 90% of our kids in Connecticut are going to be educated in a public school across the state, and we need to make sure that we don't, shirk our responsibility to them. So I think charter schools have shown that they can work. They are a public school option, but we can't do that at the expense of our public school system.
Do you support the teacher evaluation system that's been slowed down a little bit, but that would enhance the way teachers are evaluated around not just the Common Core state standards, but also around standardized testing? It's been a big controversial issue as I think about Ralph Nader coming on tomorrow in an emerging left-right alliance. It seems that there are people to the left of Governor Malloy who aren't that happy about Common Core and teacher evaluations, and there are people to the right of Governor Malloy. I'm wondering how you feel about this and where you stand on both the Common Core as it's currently constituted and also this teacher evaluation system that we have that we're working toward.
I think Common Core is a mistake. I have an eighth grader who's taken the SBAC test, and I can tell you that it wasn't helping her. There's an anxiety that she was feeling, her classmates, and she's in Fairfield. You know, my brother will tell you in Bridgeport, kids are taking a test online and they don't even have computers at their home. So I think that was a mistake. I think rushing through it was a mistake. In terms of teacher evaluations, I supported the education reform and felt that I got a little duped, because I think the implementation by Commissioner Pryor was a huge mistake, and it's one of the reasons why I called for his resignation. Linking teacher evaluations to test scores and SBAC is a huge mistake. We're at one point we were just synthesizing a teacher down to a number. Teaching is an art more than it is a science. And the Peak Commission has made recommendations to de-link that. I'm very supportive of that. I don't think we've done a good enough job listening to teachers, the people on the front lines of our public education system. I've said if elected governor, my commissioner of education is going to be someone who has experience as a teacher in our public school system, because they are the people that we need to listen to first and foremost. Should we evaluate teachers? Yes. Should we have their evaluation linked and be a test scores of their students be a significant part of that? No.
Let's go to John, who is calling from Kensington. Hi there, John. Go ahead.
Good morning. I want to challenge Mr. McKinney, and probably not to him, but maybe more to Mr. Foley. I think all candidates running for governor should pledge not to put in their own personal fortune as a loan to their campaign committee, and then go ahead and raise the money after the election or after the reporting. I want to know who gives you money before I vote for you or your opponent. You might want to challenge your competitors to do the same. I think it's such a diversion from our public financing laws and our disclosures of where the money's coming from.
John, thank you very much for that. So maybe you can address the few things that John said in there.
Well, I'm participating in the public financing campaign. I don't have enough money to self-finance, and if I did, I wouldn't.
Did you support the law when it was passed?
I did not, and there are a couple of reasons. First and foremost, there were parts of that initial law that I stood up in the Senate and said, these are violative of our First Amendment rights, and as it turned out, a federal district court agreed with me and struck down parts of the law, and there were other things I didn't like about it. look, in terms of my opponents, they're free to do whatever they want. The reality is self-funders rarely win. So I would love to run against self-funders. but, you know, I think we need to have a serious discussion, though, about campaign finance reform, because the promise was to take special interest money out of the system. And what happened under Governor Malloy is we've actually increased special interest money. We're just bringing it through a side door or, in some cases, a back door. So one of the bigger differences between Governor Malloy and I is, for example, the governor has gone out and dramatically sought $10,000 contributions for the Democrat State Party. Republicans can do the same thing from people who have contracts with the state or who are applying for contracts with the state of Connecticut. I've said that when I'm governor, I will change the law so that people who have state contracts cannot give $10,000 to the state party. I will limit how much they can give. $100, just like everybody else, is the right way to do it. And if the legislature doesn't agree with me, I will not seek that money from state contractors for my party. I think he has perverted the system. You look at how many people, and the best example is one of the more recent ones, a gentleman who lives in Pennsylvania who you know, runs the – has a company that has the contract to run the Excel Center. He's never given to any candidate or any Democrat in the state of Connecticut ever, shows up and gives a $10,000 check to the Democrat State Party, and his business has a contract for millions of dollars. Look, hardworking people across Connecticut can't write a $10,000 check. That was the promise of campaign finance reform. The maximum contribution would be $100 so that the billionaires, the CEOs of corporations couldn't have special influence in our system. And we've allowed that to happen. Governor Malloy pushed the bill. I will try to reverse that.
Okay, but you do support some sort of public financing system. That you didn't support it when you had a chance to vote on it, but you do support some sort of public financing system. What would you support? I mean, what would it look like under your administration?
Well, if you're going to have public dollars, look, I think the best example I'd give you is a state rep race, for example. I would give candidates for state rep a number of stamps or frank mail privileges so they can mail to the people they want to mail rather than spend money on, campaign parties and the like and T-shirts and that. That's public money being spent on those types of things, which are a waste. I think we have to have an honest conversation with the media, with radio, television, and newspapers about freeing up time and space for both sides to make equal presentations. One of the great things when you run for the state legislature, very small local races, is that usually the League of Women Voters will sponsor an insert in your local paper where they give both candidates or candidates from both parties equal time. We need to do a better job of that.
We got an email from Lauren. We're running very low on time. Where do you stand on collective bargaining for public sector unions?
I don't have any intention to get rid of collective bargaining for public sector unions, but I do think we need to have a discussion about our unfunded pension and health care liabilities in the state of Connecticut. We are worst in the nation, and we need to make some changes to make our fiscal future more safe and secure than it is right now. I think we have to understand that defined benefit plans are dinosaurs. They don't exist anymore in the private sector. Most municipalities are getting rid of them. And I think as a state, we have to look at getting rid of those for new hires as well.
You've talked about the need to retain jobs. You want lower tax rates. What about tax incentives to keep companies from moving? It's something Governor Malloy has been criticized for, but he has also, frankly, gotten a lot of jobs to either stay here or come here over the course of the last couple of years.
Well, I don't know if he's gotten a lot of jobs to stay here. We can have a debate about that. But do I think we should give $115 million to the world's largest hedge fund so they can move about 14 miles from Westport to Stamford? No, I do not. I would not support that. I think you need to understand why it is that a company would want to leave Connecticut. Usually it's high taxes. Usually it's affordability. Usually it's government regulation.
But because we just have a minute or so, here's what happens. All the company has to do is say, we're going to leave. And then the governor of this state or any other state says, well, what else can I possibly do? If you're governor, you'll be faced with the same thing. If they say we're going to leave and go to Pennsylvania, what are you going to do?
But that's the problem. There's not enough money in the world to pay every company, because what they've all learned is they can just raise their hand and say, hey, we're thinking about leaving. You got to draw the line. You got to say, you know what, we're not going to pay you to stay here. We're going to fix the problem so you want to stay here. And you may lose somebody. You may. But when you fix the problem, you're gonna save more than you lose at the end of the day.
I have 30 seconds left. Are you having fun doing this?
I love it. Yeah. one of the lessons that I learned is that you have to – you need to have goals that you want to achieve in life, but you need to enjoy the journey. And I love – I get the opportunity every day to go out and meet people and talk to people about how I can try to help them. That's a great experience, and I love it.
John McKinney is a state senator. He is running for governor. He's a Republican. Thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Tomorrow, it's The Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe and I will welcome in a special guest, Ralph Nader, from my hometown of Winsted. We'll have a lot to talk about. I hope you can join us on the next Where We Live.